Chapter 40. Vos, Don les eu divins sur la terre des hommes en verse plus de pleurs que vos pieds non depis, dans le ciel où nous sommes, fait éclair de fleurs. Vase d'election, edel matinale, miroir de purit, vos cui prius pour nous, d'une vix virginale, la supreme bond. Amantur, adjurdue, bien hirus Marie, j'tombe vos genouts, dignes donc mecouder. Car qu'est vos KG pri, vos cui prius pour nous. Which may be thus interpreted. O Virgin blessed, by whom the bitter draught so often has been quaffed, that, for thy sorrow, thou art named by us the Mother Dolorous. Thou, from whose eyes have fallen more tears of woe, upon the earth below, than neath thy footsteps, in this heaven of ours, have risen flowers. O beaming morning star! O chosen vase! O mirror of all grace, who, with thy virgin voice, dost ever pray man's sins away, bend down thine ear, and list, O blessed saint, unto my sad complaint, mother, to thee I kneel, on thee I call, who hearest all. She proceeds to request, that she may be allowed to return to earth, and follow the fortunes of Don Juan, and, as there is one difficulty, or, to use her own words, mace, Com vos savus quox vos eternels, malger moi, tend mon vol, selfless sur mon etel et dedicis messales, poor menchainer o soul. Her request is granted, her star is blown out, o poetic illusion. And she descends to earth to love, and to go mad, and to die for Don Juan. The reader will require no further explanation, in order to be satisfied, as to the moral of this play. But is it not a very bitter satire upon the country, which calls itself the politest nation in the world, that the incidents, the indecency, the coarse blasphemy, and the vulgar wit of this piece, should find admirers among the public, and procure reputation for the author? Could not the government, which has re-established, in a manner, the theatrical censorship, and forbids or alters plays which touch on politics, exert the same guardianship over public morals? The honest English reader, who has a faith in his clergyman, and is a regular attendant at Sunday worship, will not be a little surprised at the march of intellect among our neighbors across the channel, and at the kind of consideration in which they hold their religion. Here is a man who seizes upon saints and angels, merely to put sentiments in their mouths which might suit a nymph of Drury Lane. He shows heaven, in order that he may carry debauch into it, and avails himself of the most sacred and sublime parts of our creed as a vehicle for a scene painter's skill, or an occasion for a handsome actress to wear a new dress. M. Dumas's piece of Aeneas is not quite so sublime. It was brought out by the author as a satire upon the French critics, who, to their credit be it spoken, had generally attacked him, and was intended by him, and received by the public, as a faithful portraiture of English manners. As such, it merits special observation and praise. In the first act you find a countess and an ambassadress, whose conversation relates purely to the great actor. All the ladies in London are in love with him, especially the two present. As for the ambassadress, she prefers him to her husband, a matter of course in all French plays, and to a more seducing person still no less a person than the Prince of Wales, who presently waits on the ladies, and joins in their conversation concerning Keane. His man, says His Royal Highness, is the very pink of fashion. Brummel is nobody when compared to him, and I myself only an insignificant private gentleman. He has a reputation among ladies, for which I sigh in vain, and spends an income twice as great as mine. This admirable historic touch at once paints the actor and the prince, the estimation in which the one was held, and the modest economy for which the other was so notorious. Then we have Keane, at a place, called the Trou de Charbon, the Old Hole, where, to the edification of the public, he engages in a fisty combat with a notorious boxer. This scene was received by the audience with loud exclamations of delight, and commented on, by the journals, as a faultless picture of English manners. He call all beyond the banks of the Thames. A nobleman, Lord Melbourne, has chosen the tavern as a rendezvous for a gang of pirates, who are to have their ship in waiting, in order to carry off a young lady with whom his lordship is enamored. It need not be said, that Keane arrives at the nick of time, saves the innocent Miss Anna, and exposes the infamy of the peer. A violent tirade against noblemen ensues, and Lord Melbourne slinks away, disappointed, to meditate revenge. Keane's triumphs continue through all the acts. The ambassadress falls madly in love with him, the prince becomes furious at his ill success, and the ambassador dreadfully jealous. They pursue Keane to his dressing room at the theater, where, unluckily, the ambassadress herself has taken refuge. Dreadful quarrels ensue. The tragedian grows suddenly mad upon the stage, and so cruelly insults the Prince of Wales, that his Royal Highness determines to send him to Botany Bay. His sentence, however, is commuted to banishment to New York, whither, of course, Miss Anna accompanies him, rewarding him, previously, with her hand and 20,000 a year. This wonderful performance was gravely received, and admired by the people of Paris. The piece was considered to be decidedly moral, because the popular candidate was made to triumph throughout, and to triumph in the most virtuous manner, for, according to the French code of morals, success among women is, at once, the proof and the reward of virtue. The sacred personage introduced in Dumas's play Behind a Cloud, figures bodily in the piece of The Massacre of the Innocents, represented at Paris last year. She appears under a different name, but the costume is exactly that of Carlo Dolce's Madonna, and an ingenious fable is arranged, the interest of which hangs upon the grand massacre of the innocents, perpetrated in the fifth act. One of the chief characters is John Le Precurseur, who threatens woe to Herod and his race, and is beheaded by orders of that sovereign. In the Festin de Balthazar, we are similarly introduced to Daniel, and the first scene is laid by the waters of Babylon, where a certain number of captive Jews are seated in melancholy postures. A Babylonian officer enters, exclaiming, "Chantas nos quelques chansons de Jerusalem," and the request is refused in the language of the psalm. Belshazzar's feast is given in a grand tableau, after Martin's picture. That painter, in like manner, furnished scenes for the deluge. Vast numbers of schoolboys and children are brought to see these pieces. The lower classes delight in them. The famous Jew Ferrand, at the theater of the Port St. Martin, was the first of the kind, and its prodigious success, no doubt, occasioned the number of imitations which the other theaters have produced. The taste of such exhibitions, of course, every English person will question, but we must remember the manners of the people among whom they are popular, and, if I may be allowed to hazard such an opinion, there is in every one of these boulevard mysteries, a kind of rude moral. The boulevard writers don't pretend to tabernacles and divine gifts, like Madame Sand and Dumas before mentioned. If they take a story from the sacred books, they garble it without mercy, and take sad liberties with the text, but they do not deal in descriptions of the agreeably wicked, or ask pity and admiration for tender-hearted criminals and philanthropic murderers, as their betters do. Vice is vice on the boulevard, and it is fine to hear the audience, as a tyrant king roars out cruel sentences of death, or a bereaved mother pleads for the life of her child, making their remarks on the circumstances of the scene. H. Le Gredin, growls an indignant countryman. "Ool monster," says a grisette, in a fury. "You see very fat old men crying like babies, and, like babies, sucking enormous sticks of barley sugar." Actors and audience enter warmly into the illusion of the piece, and so especially are the former affected, that at Franconi's, where the battles of the empire are represented, there is as regular gradation in the ranks of the mimic army as in the real imperial legions. After a man has served, with credit, for a certain number of years in the line, he is promoted to be an officer, an acting officer. If he conducts himself well, he may rise to be a colonel or a general of division. If ill, he is degraded to the ranks again, or, worst degradation of all, drafted into a regiment of Cossacks or Austrians. Cossacks is the lowest depth, however. Nay, it is said that the men who perform these Cossack parts receive higher wages than the mimic grenadiers and old guard. They will not consent to be beaten every night, even in play, to be pursued in hundreds by a handful of French, to fight against their beloved emperor. Surely there is fine hearty virtue in this, and pleasant childlike simplicity. So that while the drama of Victor Hugo, Dumas, and the enlightened classes is profoundly immoral and absurd, the drama of the common people is absurd, if you will, but good and right-hearted. I have made notes of one or two of these pieces, which all have good feeling and kindness in them, and which turn, as the reader will see, upon one or two favorite points of popular morality. A drama that obtained a vast success at the Port Saint Martin was A Duchesse de la Vauballière. The Duchess is the daughter of a poor farmer, who was carried off in the first place, and then married by M. le Duc de la Vauballière, a terrible rowet, the farmer's landlord, and the intimate friend of Philippe d'Orléans, the regent of France. Now the Duke, in running away with the lady, intended to dispense altogether with ceremony, and make of Julie anything but his wife. But Georges, her father, and one more so, a notary, discovered him in his dastardly act, and pursued him to the very feet of the regent, who compelled the pair to marry and make it up. Julie complies, but though she becomes a duchess, her heart remains faithful to her old flame, Adrian, the doctor, and she declares that, beyond the ceremony, no sort of intimacy shall take place between her husband and herself. Then the Duke begins to treat her in the most ungentlemanlike manner. He abuses her in every possible way, he introduces improper characters into her house, and, finally, becomes so disgusted with her that he determines to make away with her altogether. For this purpose, he sends forth into the highways and seizes a doctor, bidding him, on pain of death, to write a poisonous prescription for Madame la Duchesse. She swallows the potion, and oh horror, the doctor turns out to be Dr. Adrian, whose woe may be imagined, upon finding that he has been thus committing murder on his true love. Let not the reader, however, be alarmed as to the fate of the heroine. No heroine of a tragedy ever yet died in the third act, and, accordingly, the Duchess gets up perfectly well again in the fourth, through the instrumentality of Morisot, the good lawyer. And now it is that vice begins to be really punished. The Duke, who, after killing his wife, thinks it necessary to retreat and take refuge in Spain, is tracked to the borders of that country by the virtuous notary, and there receives such a lesson as he will never forget to his dying day. Morisot, in the first instance, produces a deed signed by His Holiness the Pope, which annuls the marriage of the Duc de la Vauballière. Then another deed, by which it is proved that he was not the eldest son of old La Vauballière, the former duke. Then another deed, by which he shows that old La Vauballière, who seems to have been a disreputable old fellow, was a bigamist, and that, in consequence, the present man, styling himself duke, is illegitimate. And finally, Morisot brings forward another document, which proves that the Réglard Duke is no other than Adrian, the doctor. Thus it is that love, law, and physic combined triumph over the horrid machinations of this star and gartered libertine. Herman Livren is another piece of the same order, and though not very refined, yet possesses considerable merit. As in the case of the celebrated Captain Smith of Halifax, who took to drinking ratafia, and thought of poor Miss Bailey, a woman and the bottle have been the cause of Herman's ruin. Deserted by his mistress, who has been seduced from him by a base Italian count, Herman, a German artist, gives himself entirely up to liquor and revenge. But when he finds that force, and not infidelity, have been the cause of his mistress's ruin, the reader can fancy the indignant ferocity with which he pursues the infamous ravisseur. A scene, which is really full of spirit, and excellently well acted, here ensues. Hermann proposes to the Count, on the eve of their duel, that the survivor should bind himself to espouse the unhappy Marie. But the Count declares himself to be already married, and the student, finding a duel impossible, for his object was to restore, at all events, the honor of Marie, now only thinks of his revenge, and murders the Count. Presently, two parties of men enter Hermann's apartment. One is a company of students, who bring him the news that he has obtained the prize of painting, the other the policemen, who carry him to prison, to suffer the penalty of murder. I could mention many more plays in which the popular morality is similarly expressed. The seducer, or rascal of the piece, is always an aristocrat, a wicked count, or licentious marquis, who is brought to condign punishment just before the fall of the curtain. And to good reason have the French people had to lay such crimes to the charge of the aristocracy, who are expiating now, on the stage, the wrongs which they did 100 years since. The aristocracy is dead now, but the theater lives upon traditions. And don't let us be too scornful at such simple legends as are handed down by the people from race to race. Vulgar prejudice against the great it may be, but prejudice against the great is only a rude expression of sympathy with the poor. Long, therefore, may fat epiciers blubber over mimic woes, and honest proletars shake their fists, shouting, "Redin, Celerit, Monster de Marquis!" And such republican cries. Remark 2. Another development of this same popular feeling of dislike against men in power. What a number of plays and legends have we, the writer, has submitted to the public, in the preceding pages, a couple of specimens, one of French, and the other of Polish origin, in which that great and powerful aristocrat, the devil, is made to be miserably tricked, humiliated, and disappointed? A play of this class, which, in the midst of all its absurdities and claptraps, had much of good in it, was called E Maudit des Mers. La Maudit is a Dutch captain, who, in the midst of a storm, while his crew were on their knees at prayers, blasphemed and drank punch. But what was his astonishment at beholding an archangel with a sword all covered with flaming resin, who told him that as he, in this hour of danger, was too daring, or too wicked, to utter a prayer, he never should cease roaming the seas until he could find some being who would pray to heaven for him. Once only, in 100 years, was the skipper allowed to land for Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.